Thank you very much, Philip. I'm now delighted to introduce our discuss it for today's panel, Martha Hildreth, who is Associate Professor of History here at University of Nevada, Reno. Martha is the author of numerous books, articles, book chapters, notably her monograph, Physicians, Bureaucrats, and Public Health in France, 1888 to 1902. She's also the co-editor of a volume, Disease and Medical Care in the Mountain West, Essays on Region, History, and Practice. And finally, she's working on a new manuscript, The Brotherhood, the French Medical Syndicates, and the Creation of Private Practice in France, 1888 to 1930. Thank you so much, Martha. Well, it's a real pleasure to be able to comment on a panel where the papers fit together so well around the themes of migration and disaster and response to disaster. I see my task here to underline the authors' contributions and also to point to some of their common themes. I'll do so more or less chronologically in time, and I want to start with making comments about the bubonic plague. Well, thanks to the History Channel and other media, if you ask anyone with just a passing interest in the past today to name one of the worst natural disasters in human history, the 14th century Black Death will certainly get center stage. But and by the way, sometimes I think the History Channel couldn't exist without the Black Plague and Nazis. Anyway, but aside from this lurid fascination, it clearly was one of the worst disasters, at least one of the worst of the so-called natural disasters of human history. So it's a subject of justified importance for academic scholars as well as the History Channel. But it's sometimes forgotten, as Irmas reminds us, that in the late Renaissance and early modern period, the plague continued to hit again and again, although in more confined geographical spaces than it did in the 14th century. Therefore, it was epidemic rather than pandemic, bringing with it all these recurring, terrible local disasters. It wasn't the last pandemic. Notably, there was another pandemic that dates from the 1890s into the early part of the 20th century that spread from Asia into San Francisco and into the rodent population of the West and of the Central Plains of the United States. And as Irmas reminded us, we're in the middle of another one of these epidemics in Madagascar. But here in Reno, with the Sierras framing our western border, we hear about every two or three years of some child playing in a campground, coming into contact with a squirrel and getting bubonic plague. Not too long ago in the Midwest, there was a fad of prairie dogs as pets. And there was a very bad case of a young woman who caught bubonic plague from a pet prairie dog. As I emphasize to my students in the history of medicine, burrowing rodents do not make good pets. Unlike today, in 1720, its continuing threat in the Mediterranean world was well understood. Hence, there was a remarkable system of quarantine, police sanitaire, and other public health measures, some of them quite grim for the sick and dying and cruel for their survivors, but thought necessary. Unfortunately, though, if you lock sick bubonic plague victims in their homes, and then after they die, you later burn down their homes, you haven't done anything to stop the rats from getting out. And in fact, you're encouraging them from getting out. In Marseille in 1720, as is so very eloquently described in this paper, the system of vigilance and quarantine first broke down when officials went into denial and therefore created what could have possibly been just a very small epidemic, maybe confined to the Vieux-Port, to spread throughout the city and from the city out into the countryside of Provence. This is a pattern that we know very well from the Black Death of the 14th century, where you have these nodes of port cities or trade cities, trade centers, where the epidemic first fires up, and then from there it will spread out into a kind of a net-like pattern into the countryside. Well, so the breakdown, as we see, in the local police sanitaire allowed the horror in. It's a testament to both the power and also the fears of the French state of the Regency, and also to the well-implanted public fears of the plague, that the forces of the crown were brought to bear when local authority had failed. Okay. One of the things that this paper does very eloquently is describe this massive effort at blockade, which used so many different measures, including some of the very typical ones that we know from the 14th, 15th, and 16th century, such as the blockades of the shipping and the inspections, those blockades of roads, but also, and even the health certificates which were not an entirely new thing, but also this wall, which is just an incredible story to hear about. Okay. These measures included this massive military force, with travel was interdicted, public places were shut down. And so this really expands the kind of institutional response to the plague that was pioneered by the cities of northern Italy in the 15th century. Migration is part of the story of the plague, certainly. I want to suggest also that there's another kind of migration besides the migration of people or the limiting of the migration, the movement of people, and that's the migration of the bacteria of Yersinia pestis and its flea host and the flea's rodent host, as we now understand quite well, gets established in an area, proliferates in the right conditions, and then transmits to humans. Since Yersin's work of around 1900, this is all very well understood. But as Irmas shows us, in the 1720-1723 Marseille plague, long before any of these agents and vectors were known, empirically, authorities had come to understand that bubonic plague came upon the trade routes with their ships, with its putrefying and putrefied corpses, its infected passengers and crew, who were also putrefying quite visibly as they were still alive, with their pus-filled, weeping sores, the buboes that give the name to bubonic plague, and thanks also to the trade goods themselves. It was known that it could also come overland. By the 17th century, it was realized, what has been since experimentally verified, that the infected rodent flea can travel a long time in a dormant stage in bales of hay or wool or bolts of cloth. So did the system work, this massive effort to confine this terrible epidemic to Provence? Well, given the topography of Provence, it simply doesn't seem to me possible that all peoples, traders, and their wares, let alone the rodents and their deadly bacteria, could have been entirely stopped and prevented from moving out. If you think about what the Durance and the Verdun river valleys look like, it would have been pretty hard to stop everybody from getting out. Also, we know from other accounts of the plague that certificates of health weren't always a good technique, because people bribed the officials. Also, they would, make sure that they were covering up their buboes with their clothes so they wouldn't visually look like plague victims. Of course, they smelled, so you had to, they really did smell badly, and so you had to wear some kind of a perfumed ball or something, or a lot of cologne, but you could hide that from the people. Okay, the most important effort, the thing that certainly worked, was of course ship blockade, ship quarantines. It's very clear that shipping was the main way, with the passengers and also the goods, was the main way that the plague could move from one place to another. So this international blockade that's described here of French ships was probably very, very effective. Okay. Now, most historians do agree that the kinds of massive efforts to stop overland communication probably did have some effect. This is from McNeil's work, Plagues and Peoples. This has been pretty much accepted. But McNeil also describes how climate dependent the fleas were, and also the rodents. And so one can imagine that as the disease was moving, you know, from the most southern areas of Provence into the hinterland of Provence, you know, maybe they got to a point where the climate just wasn't very friendly to the fleas. It was too dry. It likes a temperate climate. It might have just been too dry and too hot. And so the fleas, you know, would stop reproducing and stop their patterns by which they spread. It's an interesting question. It's probably impossible to know. A central part of the contribution of this article is to describe the massive amount of inquiries, of commentaries, of medical documents, of legal opinions that were generated internationally by this 1720 outbreak, along with these controversies over etiology. Now, I'd like to suggest here, however, when it comes to the etiology ideas of the time, wasn't always a very clear distinction between miasmatists and people who believed in contagion theory, as I'm sure you know, because traditionally, you know, this idea that putrefaction was one of the ways in which the disease was both caused and then reproduced was sort of an amalgamation of miasmatic theory along with theories about transmission of diseases from person to person. I think one of the, as the author here gets more deeply into this massive and fascinating corpus of primary sources, she will no doubt shed light and help us understand this whole problem more thoroughly. Now, emerging scholarship on disasters stressed the idea that natural disasters should be put in quotations where the term natural is taken to mean outside of human activity. In fact, this term, the recent scholarship suggests, is misleading. I want to thank Chris Church for turning me on to this scholarship and giving me some articles that illustrate that. Much of what this literature suggests is much of what is called a natural disaster is not truly the result of a random event of nature. Many disasters are in part the outcome of human interactions with the rest of nature. In fact, in the case of bubonic plague, one of the landmark theories is that of William McNeill, who posited that the disturbance of the steppe lands caused in Asia, caused by the Mongols, disturbed the burrowing rodents in those areas, sent them above ground, migrating south into China and then west and eventually along the trade routes in the gut of the flea, and along with their fleas, and in the gut of the flea, Yersinia pestis. Now, in the phylloxera in Burgundy, there's also a possible parallel to the interaction between the phenomenon of plants and non-human animals and human activities. As Whalen notes, this terrible louse-caused plague arrived in the vineyards along with some awful fungal diseases, all of which developed at or just after the mid-19th century. Harry Paul has suggested that the intensification of agriculture in France that was characteristic of the area of the era unleashed the conditions for these diseases of the vine. Now, sick vines were not the only problem of the agricultural economy. Just a few years prior to phylloxera's worst impact in France, France was hit with two other major epidemics that struck at its agricultural economy: anthrax in cattle and sheep, and pabrine in the silkworm. Just as humans, when humans live close together in large numbers, as they began to do so in the cities of Renaissance Italy and then generally in early modern Europe, so too when plants and fields and herds are concentrated, conditions are ripe for infection and transmission. Those intensely cultivated fields are like the crowded cities of the era. And like the cities, the fields are also linked in international system, as Whalen has shown. Thus, the phylloxera became a pandemic. One of the suggestions that Whalen mentions in the article came from Guyot, recommended that there should indeed be less crowded planting. And this would, of course, help this disease not to implant itself so readily. As the disease of phylloxera was international, so was finally the solution. As Whalen shows, grudgingly it seems, French owners had to accept that their roots and vines were no more robust than America's roots and vines. And it's fascinating to me that after first banning it, American rootstock became the main solution. But before that, France, of course, called in its networks of great academic scientists, the chemists. In fact, he was famously recruited to solve the Pabrine and anthrax crises, Louis Pasteur, at least officially, sat on a committee for solving phylloxera. However, other prominent chemists took the lead, most notably Jean-Baptiste Dumas, decreeing the chemical solutions that, as Whalen describes, did not turn out well in all cases. I love this the irony here. I see an irony here that this most advanced experimental French science failed, and a kind of hands-in-the-dirt solution from America prevailed. On migration, Whalen's article shows us this major dislocation that was caused for growers, large and small, dislocation of individuals, which must, of course, meant their families and their communities, too. Reading his vivid account of the sick leaves and the damaged roots, I imagine the dread of a grower anxiously inspecting his vines, seeing this first horrifying evidence of this awful louse, and then looking closer at the base of the plants, putting his hand down into the soil, uncovering the roots, and seeing the awful thing itself. It must have been a real horror for these individuals. His vineyard is done. His family is perhaps done in. And from what Whalen describes, there were both immediate and long-term dislocations as it's just massive change in agricultural crises. It was lucky for the small growers that the epidemic coincided with the transformative law in French society, the law of 1884, which legalized unions, the cooperatives, and the syndicates. This had far-ranging impact in society. We see it very clearly here, but there are many, many examples of how these syndicates and cooperatives really revolutionized small businesses and as well as agriculture in France. But I wonder about the day laborers. They must have suffered and scattered. Can we know more about them? I'd like to know, is it at this moment that seasonal immigrant labor becomes an important part of the vine of the vineyards? Is it this moment that Portuguese grape pickers are brought in and Spanish grape pickers are brought in? Well, we know very well from the Katrina disaster that when such disasters come, the poor suffer the most and are given the fewest resources to reconstitute their lives. And so it is the case that Chris Church describes in his account of Martinique and Pelé's eruptions. Pelé's eruptions really do fit the stereotype of a natural disaster. For as I know, researchers have not associated volcanoes with human activity. However, the response of the government that Chris Church describes shares commonalities with the government response in the other two epidemics. The focus is in all cases is on economics and on control, on stopping the inherent disorder and recovering normality. In all cases, charity, human aid, is not the main concern. In Martinique, there was short-term aid for the refugees, but for women and children, as Church describes, and the weak, the so-called deserving poor, as they were noted at the time. But even this aid was short-term. When families were evacuated and forced to relocate, as authorities decreed, it was up to themselves then to reestablish themselves. The aid was over. I think again of Katrina, where families were channeled to Houston, and then they were pretty much left on their own to reconstitute their lives with very few resources. Also, parenthetically, when I was reading this article, I was reminded, which talks about disaster tourism, that Katrina has also seen disaster tourism, in which I have to confess I took part. And but my only excuse is I was accompanying a medical anthropologist who was doing a study at the time. But getting back to Martinique, I would like to know more about this national commission that was formed in the 1929 disaster, and the changing politics of the time, how it structured this national commission, what auspices under which it was formed, who got put in it, and can we make any comparisons to FEMA in the Katrina disasters? Okay. George emphasizes how the 1902 disaster response determined the 1929 response. Focus was on recovering the economy, on the powerful and the wealthy, on restoring the export economy, and, of course, on restoring the social disorder. Inherent here is the idea, as he describes, that the poor, and here, of course, the poor were the Afro-Caribbean population, to give them aid was to bring about laziness and long-term disorder. Academic analysis of Katrina and of the disaster discourses in the media and the disaster relief in Katrina have told us pretty much the same thing. It's a transnational, stigmatizing, racialized trope of modernity with vicious consequences. Getting back to French customs of charity in the 19th century, I have a question for both Whelan and Church about, and that is about the Bureau de Bienfaisance. The Bureau de Bienfaisance existed in many, many communes in the metropole and had since before the Third Republic. By the time of the Third Republic, the Bureau were well established, along with the principle that the government had some responsibility for the deserving destitute, for the indigents, as long as those people were part of a local community. My question for Whelan is, did the Bureau de Bienfaisance intervene in any way to try and help the displaced growers or their laborers? Looking at Martinique, by 1929, the French nation, in the metropole at least, was very much committed to a system of social aid, long-term social aid. And social aid had become nationalized by 1929, where at one time it had been invested in the commune. Now it was dispensed in the form of a number of national programs that date from the 1880s. There are even more after 1918, focusing on relieving people whose families were very damaged by loss of life in the First World War, of loss of the breadwinner in the First World War. It seems like the state charity programs and the metropole simply did not apply to Martinique. It seems like the structures of social networks and social responsibilities that prevailed before the war continued after the war. This underscores Church's larger points regarding labor and racial ideologies of the colonies that figured in the response to Pelé. My question to him is that, also, were there any Bureau de Bienfaisance, these local this local bureau that were supposed to aid people in the immediate community, and did they do anything in 1902 or in 1929? Well, I enjoyed reading these papers very much. They sent me back to rereading some classic works that I loved in the past, and I want to thank my colleague, Chris Church, for asking me to comment and also pointing towards some interesting literature about natural disasters, which I read with great fascination. Thank you very much.
Well, we have just about 15 minutes for comments and questions. Would you all like to take a minute to respond to Martha's comments, or would you like to kind of integrate your response to Martha's comments by Q&A? Up to you.
That would be okay opening it up.
Okay, so let's address Martha's wonderful feedback as part of the Q&A, then we'll open up.
In that case. Cindy, because we're looking at an early modern state rather than late 19th century or 20th century, the question of, you know, what government was like in the absolutist era comes up in a comparative sense. Does the Catholic Church have a role to play at all in this?
Absolutely.
And second, how do you get data from migration? Because if you don't have good census data, or do you, how do you know how many people are fleeing other than like the anecdotal stuff you have?
Right. Fortunately for that side of things, as far as population numbers, demographics, the work of earlier French historians, they did a lot of the work for me.
Ah, that's always good.
Zach Birabe.
Birabe.
Yeah, thank you. I was like, that's something that doesn't sound right. Carrier, for that matter, as far as those kind of technicalities go. But as far as, does that answer your second question?
Yeah, and then I just also wanted to send a quick one to Philip before I pass
this one. Yeah.
In your earlier work also, you talk about the role of the American vines. Why couldn't they use European vines? And why is it a Burgundy-type issue? Because I would think, first of all, it would become a more French or Central East Central European wide issue, and why go all the way to America for the assistance? So, thank you.
To answer your first question, absolutely, the Catholic Church had a big role in it. One of the most famous figures, I suppose, of initially local, becomes he becomes a legend locally, and then remains in the historical record in many ways, and he penned a whole memoir on the plague, Bishop Belsunce in Marseille, who's even been memorialized in paintings, in the artwork of the time. Plague, really, about this particular outbreak, Michel Serre, the artist, I believe, has includes him in some of his works. And so the Catholic Church's role, that's where they step in. When the emerging nation state in France at this time, the centralized state, is very much kind of flexing its muscles during the 1720 plague. They're stepping in. They're establishing increased communication with Provence in this case. And as I said, into the 19th century, it's the successes, it's remembered as a success, the successes of the 1720 response in France and abroad is just, they try to replicate it anytime during the yellow fever era that will follow. They step in, they read these texts, and they're like, oh, we should look back to how they did it in 1720 because it was such a success. The plague never left France, right? Or never left southern France. So that's the legacy there as far as the state. But the Catholic Church then comes in and tries to kind of says, well, hold on a minute. The success was at the hands of God because Belsunce arrived in Marseille just in the nick of time to save the populace with his, his required, mandatory, I should say, religious marches and processions and all of these kind of things, a fasting. Right, he is known to have been himself in the crowds of people, helping them, helping the sick, and having managed to survive it somehow. So there. I would describe the Catholic Church's role in this time, large as it was, as kind of like self-imposed. Like they're kind of get in there, mm-hmm. Like, well, let's not forget that the Catholics had a big role in saving the world, I guess, in some degree. Keeping the plague from leaving France. So, in short, right? Does that answer your question?
Terrific. Oh, with regards to the origins of phylloxera, it's a good question. I've never seen references in the works that I consult where they might be asking, well, why don't we go to Iran to get some vines, right? But what this does underscore is already the fact that the United States is an agricultural industrial powerhouse, because they're already importing the vines from America. Now, what happened is they got the aphids, probably, with the American vines. See, the aphids and the American vines evolved together in this climate, removed from the ecology of the American, various parts of the United States and South America, brought to Europe, things depart. So the solution, again, is to go back and get those American vines. But, I mean, they had been importing them all along. But there's more to it. And I also appreciate your comment about looking at local agencies of support. I can imagine that'd be worth pursuing.
I have a question, but I'm afraid of not. very well thought out, but it sort of stems from one of the maps that you showed, Chris, and so it's actually a question for the entire panel. But I'm just wondering how these different disasters sort of helped to reconfigure the way that people thought about space and geography in these areas and helped to create new boundaries and borders and the long-term effects of those, both for demographics, demographic growth, and then also for thinking about, you know, Bordeaux as a region. Like, how do these disasters shape these kinds of sense of place and self, but also create new boundaries and sort of with that, perhaps new structural inequalities that emerge with it?
That's a fascinating reconfiguration from the map that I showed, because in Martinique, it very clearly does. The debates over reconstruction, both during the three-year eruption and after, were heavily focused on the lines on the map known as the volcanic zone, with all of the weight that that carried. So I think it's because, it was... So 1902, the eruption of 1902, essentially creates the modern field of volcanology, because they get it so wrong in 1902. In 1902... A colonial expedition of scientists goes up to the crater and basically says, yes, this is going to be a non-starter. They head back to the island. They keep concentrating people in Saint-Pierre. The eruption occurs. It's not lava. It's pyroclastic flows. Comes down and just obliterates everybody. But it leaves marks in the landscape. And then and the volcanologists, for years after that, they create initially in a small observatory outpost, clearly sketch out where this occurred, where these pyroclastic flows. So as soon as the volcano starts to become active again or kind of wake up, that immediately becomes, this is the volcanic zone. And we will not rebuild inside of it. There is a talk of moving the town of Le Précheur and trying to get it farther away from the the immediate danger, possibly even out of the volcanic zone. And that hits local pushback, because people want to return back to their homes. They want to go back to their livelihoods. And in fact, people had about 2,000 people get evacuated initially. And then before that kind of second massive wave of evacuations in late October, they had already returned back to their homes, and then they get evacuated a second time. So there's this clear sense of, you know, this is the danger zone, and it has had real consequences for the area. So Saint-Pierre goes from being this kind of resurging town, possibly could regrow into a city, to being fairly desolate even today. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. Whereas Fort-de-France, on the other hand, is colossal in comparison.
Well, post for the whole panel, yeah? Okay, great. Would you like to go, Shelley?
Oh, go ahead.
Sure. So that's a really important question you ask, actually, because one of the things that we look at most in disaster studies is the role of human, the human role in causing disasters or in putting, basically creating the kind of vulnerability that allows for what is otherwise an extreme event to have a disastrous effect on the population. On society. And so space and geography, even more fundamentally than that, is probably the thing we look at most, because space is going to determine to a large extent who gets help, how quickly, in a lot of ways, who lives in vulnerable zones, what zones are vulnerable, as Chris was just pointing out, you know, for that matter, using that as an example. And for the, you know, we could say that oftentimes the most vulnerable areas are the least expensive areas, and so it's set up in such a way that the populations who move into these areas are the most, you know, they're the most vulnerable, and they're also the lower SES people, people of color, non-English speaking people, so on and so forth. And so in my work, which, in many ways, even looking beyond my, my current monograph on the 1720 plague, space and geography is just so fundamental for looking at this, like I said, zoning and vulnerability, and the areas that are resilient are going to be and kind of where you expect them to be, right?
But to go back, the space itself is socially constructed.
Because absolutely.
I'm just agreeing with you.
In
Martinique, there's this real discussion over, but the soil is so fertile. Like, if only we could get around it and you know, rebuild up in that area. We could, and so there's this very real conversation. And I didn't make it into this talk, but the other piece of this puzzle and why in 1929, aside from the overdetermination of 1902, it's easier to keep people out of the volcanic zone is because about a third or more of the white population on the island died in 1902. So those 8,000 to 10,000 people who had returned to the region are predominantly black with a small upper crust of landowners. And so I think that plays into the conversation as well as in terms of being able to push people out of the zone that has now been socially determined to be dangerous.
Let me respond to your question. Obviously, in the not so much in the case of Bordeaux, where it's the chateau that gives distinction, not necessarily the terroir. So chateau can own lands here, there, and elsewhere, and vinify all in one place and put slap a label on. There's 1,000-page-long books on terroir, right? So it's this crazy discourse. It's the totality of the vineyard habitat. That's a nifty ecological approach, and yet it doesn't exclude anything. Now, some people will differ and say, well, make it more of a biophysical thing, and others will say it's entirely the human dimension. At what stage? When? For instance, when I look at... it's very hard to know actually what was put in these vineyards back in the 19th century. Who knows what was in there? We know that there's a whole lot of chemicals in them now. Right? So there's all kinds of changes. But I think that whereas terroir can be elusive, it's also a very protean term. Right? It gives you a lot of traction. It enables all kinds of conversations, which bring sort of the cultural and the biophysical together. And I think that's to be appreciated. I would also note that there's no definition of terroir in many of the standard dictionaries of human geography, which I find very surprising.
I was interested, you mentioned in your talk that you were not going to discuss the migration to California, so I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
There was some research done in the past, and a good friend of mine who wrote a biography of Paul Masson brought to my attention that it was precisely during the phylloxera crisis that Masson first came in 1887, first came to California, and then he came back permanently in 1890. So he's a consequence of the dislocations, and rather than... I'd have to go back and find out what his family fortunes were like exactly, but they perceived the opportunities as lying here. And so they come to the hills of Santa Cruz, end up with Paul Masson Corporation. And there's also many, there's other vintners, right? Phylloxera is an international phenomenon. So at the same time, the 1770s and 1780s, you get the arrival of Italians, Germans, and French persons in the hills of Santa Cruz. So more can be done there, but it's linked to the theme of the conference that way. Thanks for asking.
And this is maybe not relevant to the theme of the conference, but in the opposite trend, with the natural disaster of the massive fires in California and Napa Valley, how do you think that might relate to what you're talking about?
I don't know. I asked myself the same question when I saw it. But there's more. Actually, what we don't know is that phylloxera is all over the place. Right, it's just controlled differently. But I mean, there's tens of thousands of acres in California are, in fact, phylloxeric, if that's the appropriate term, as is the case elsewhere. So, so when we talk about these flora and fauna, just as pestis, sometimes they're more or less virulent depending on ecological conditions and circumstances. So that's interesting. I don't know what fires like that do in the long run, presumably just destroy those vines. However, not always, because we know that very old vines can survive in the wild. And in fact, nowadays there's people who seek to find these because if a vine has a shoot that sort of touches the ground, it'll start a new plant, right? So circumstances can allow it to sort of live for a long time, which is exactly how they used to propagate them before cloning. So there's people out there who find these wild vines in areas that we believe and understand were no longer cultivated as a result of phylloxera, and will assert the claim, I don't know what exactly, that this is a pre-phylloxera vine. Now imagine if the wine tasted different. What could that mean for the terroiriste and others, right? It's fascinating, but yeah, we'll see what happens in California. Although there's no shortage of acreage in California. I mean, I've lived in California, and I've seen the groves come and go. Boy, and they just plant them in 2 years' time, and poof, you know.
Well, thank you so much to our panelists, to Martha, to the audience. It was a delightful panel, and thank you very much.
Thank you.